Today on the Bible Reading Challenge podcast, we are going to give an overview of the book of Revelation, and that's Revelation, not Revelations. There's just one. My name is Aaron Ventura, and I have two guests joining me today. Zach Wilkie is a third-year Grey Friar, which is our pastoral training program here in Moscow. He did his undergrad at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis. Shout out to Joe Rigney. And you're also doing a master's at New St. Andrews College right now, is that correct?
Yeah, finishing up.
And tell us about how your thesis is coming along.
Oh boy.
Is it coming along?
It's about to start.
Okay. Do you have a topic yet?
I've got some ideas. Need to get some proposals approved of.
Okay.
Yeah?
So you haven't really done anything?
No.
Okay. And we also have Pastor Doug Wilson. He's the pastor of Christ Church, author of a lot of books, including a new commentary on the book of Revelation, which is called When the Man Comes Around, published by Canon Press. And Pastor Doug, can you talk about how you went about writing this? You were kind of chipping away at it for a little bit.
Yeah, the way I wrote this is I send out a weekly email devotional type of exegetical devotional thing to the church. And so I would take each little section that I treat here and write probably 200 or 300 words and send it as an email to the church. So that was just a weekly chip away. And when I was done, I just assembled them, you know, put them all end to end, and there's the commentary in the main.
And I think didn't you say you were looking at a commentary that had like four different views in it as you were kind of working
through it? I think it's called Revelation, Four Views. Edited by Steve Gregg. Okay. It was really, really helpful, because what he does is he takes the four main interpretive views of the book of Revelation, which we'll get into in a minute, and he just quotes representative quotes in four columns. Okay. So he'll have the section to be commented on, and there's four columns of different interpretations.
Okay. And then you get to pick your own adventure kind of thing.
Well, yeah, you can say, this is what my guy thinks, but here's what everybody else is saying.
Yeah.
And I really found it helpful, because it was quite striking that I was edified and incorporated into this book some of the insights that were offered by men who belonged to a different school of thought entirely, because everybody's looking at the same text. When you back out to a certain level, mm-hmm. the disagreements start. Yeah. But when you get into the text tightly, the different representatives all had valuable things to say.
Yeah.
And so Steve Gregg did a wonderful work with that, Revelation, Four Views. The four schools of thought that are put in these columns throughout that book are the historicist, which basically thinks that the book of the book of Revelation was a prediction of church history, mm-hmm. and down to the present. So it's like you expect to see the book of Revelation as an unrolling carpet.
Yeah.
And it covers all of the last 2,000 years.
And they find Constantine and Martin Luther and people in the text, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, and depending, and of course, there'd be differences among the historicists.
Yeah.
But somebody might say, this is Genghis Khan, or this is, you know. and it's easy for some people to say, well, that's just ridiculous. But there are historicist interpretations of certain events that are frankly spooky, right? And that's the advantage of this four-view commentary thing, is that you get a historicist mm-hmm. making his strongest case from his strongest texts.
Yeah.
So that's the historicist. Then there's the futurist, which most evangelicals today are probably the most familiar with, and that is the idea that the book of Revelation is a prophecy of the end of the world, mm-hmm. or the events leading up to the end of the world. So that's obviously, since the world hasn't ended yet, that's still in our future. Mm-hmm. So that's the futurist view. So the idea is that John on Patmos was given a revelation of events that were to unfold thousands of years in the future. Mm-hmm. That's the futurist view. The idealist view is the idea that this is a dramatic sky parable. So God is giving us a vivid and apocalyptic description of the battle between good and evil. Mm-hmm. And it's memorable and stuff, but you'd be foolish to try to link it to any particular historical events. Mm-hmm. It's this idealistic sky parable. That's the idealist position.
Would you say that the idealist is, maybe at their worst, is kind of like a symbol without the thing signified?
Yeah. Yeah. No, but the advantage it has is that it's not falsifiable, mm-hmm. right? Right?
Because it's just a story.
It's a parable. When Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, you can't say, oh, yeah, well, you can't argue it's a story.
Yeah.
So if you're giving an idealistic description of the battle between good and evil, and good is ultimately triumphant, mm-hmm. and evil is vicious, well, all of us knew that already, anyhow. Mm-hmm. I don't find idealism that satisfying, but it is impregnable, and that you can't falsify it. The fourth view is the preterist view, and that's that view is named after a Latin word for the past. So the future has to do with our future. The preterist view says that the Book of Revelation was largely fulfilled in the first century. In our past. So when John, there's a little quirk here, because when John was given the revelation, it was in his future, mm-hmm. but it was in his very near future, instead of thousands of years. So the futurist view is thousands of years in the future with reference to John. The preterist view is months and a few years in the future from John's reference, but very much in our past.
Yeah.
So we look at the events 2,000 years ago and say, oh, this part of Revelation was fulfilled in Nero, or this part of Revelation was fulfilled here and there.
Yeah.
Those are the four basic views. And the view that I argue for in this commentary when the man comes around is the preterist view. You might call it a modified preterist view, mm-hmm. Where I take the entire book of Revelation in a preterist way, talking about events within the first century prior to 70 AD, mm-hmm. Culminating in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And with the exception of the last few chapters, the mm-hmm. descent of the New Jerusalem and the vision of glory there, I take in a historicist / futurist sense. Okay. The very end of the book hasn't happened yet. But is in the process of happening and is going to culminate. So the descriptions of the New Jerusalem descending, I think that's happening throughout church history, which would be a historicist mm-hmm. take. So preterist for the bulk of the book, historicist for the last few chapters. Okay.
If you open up any commentary on Revelation, one of the first things that they're going to do is argue about when it was
written.
Right. So how would the dating of the book land you in a different camp?
Yeah. Scholars are divided on the dating of the book between roughly those who believe that it was written prior to 70 AD and those who believe that it was written very late, like in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So pre-70 AD or late in the 90s. And everything boils down to a cryptic comment of Irenaeus. who says that John had his vision, and I forget which emperor it was, near the end of...
I think it's Domitian.
Domitian. Yeah, I was going to say it's a D. So he had his vision near that time, which would put it in the 90s. The problem is that Irenaeus is not scripture, and the statement there is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. So the ambiguity is, it could have been John, the one who saw the vision. John was seen at as late as the reign of Domitian, meaning that John lived that long.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that he saw the vision then.
Yeah.
But that's where we get the late dating of the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. But Irenaeus thought that Jesus died when he was 50. He's not necessarily. Let's take it to the bank. The main argument I see is that if you put the Book of Revelation as being given in the 90s, and you try to fit it with any of the events that follow in the second century, mm-hmm. it's just an incomprehensible book. Mm-hmm. It nothing fits, nothing clicks, nothing yeah. ties together. If you assume, let's say, that the book was written in 60 AD mm-hmm. or sometime prior to 70 AD, and you say, okay, did any events in the first century
yeah.
prior to the 70 AD, do they fit with the predictions that John makes? And here's this is the place where the different views, I think, have to push their chips out to the middle of the table. And the idealist never has to push any chips because it's not falsifiable. The futurist also has that a comparable advantage, because if I say the Book of Revelation is all about 100 years from now, then the future has the advantage of being infinitely malleable. Mm-hmm. I can make the future do anything I want.
Yeah.
I can have empires rise and fall. I can have Russians invade. I can have killer. I can have killer bees. I can
murder bees. You got to be really creative, though.
Murder hornets.
Murder hornets.
The future. I can just do. I can make the future stand up on its hind legs and walk.
Yeah.
But if I argue, as I am arguing, that the events talked about in this book were fulfilled in historical events in the first century. Mm-hmm. Well, the first century happened the way it did, and I can't whistle up some convenient answer. I've got to mesh my interpretation of the book with the history that we actually know.
Yeah.
And interestingly, the first century AD is an era we know quite a lot about.
Yeah.
From Josephus and from Tacitus and Suetonius and there are many historians writing about that period. Mm-hmm. We know who reigned. We know how long they reigned. We know how they were deposed. We know all of these. We have all these facts, a pile of first century history facts. Mm-hmm. And then if I say, okay, in this book, the beast persecutes the church for 42 months. And then John's very explicit about that. The beast persecutes the church for 42 months. Well, then I look at Nero's persecution, which goes from 64 AD to 68 AD, and it's 42 months. You know, you push the buckle into the seatbelt and it clicks. Mm-hmm. Right? You say, okay. So Nero, the persecution of Nero of the church, Nero probably set the fire for the Great Fire of Rome, probably because he wanted to do an expensive government rebuild project. He wanted to, you know, but suspicion fell on him that he was the one that set the fire, which is where the saying, Nero fiddled while Rome burned.
Yeah.
That was the expression. Well, he was just playing he was an amateur musician, and he used to enter all these contests, and lo and behold, he would win them.
Perks of being the emperor, right? Yeah.
Sort of like Donald Trump going on America's Got Talent and winning every time. You know, every season he wins. Somebody's going to say, you know, wait a minute. But Nero was that kind of. He would enter chariot races and win. He was just a narcissistic character.
Yeah.
Well, the first 5 years of his reign, it was pretty decent. And that's also, incidentally, with Romans. That's Romans 13 was written during the early part of Nero's reign, when Seneca, the philosopher, the Stoic philosopher, was his tutor and advisor, mm-hmm. and kept him sort of under restraint. But in 64, I think it was in 64, Nero murdered his mother, Agrippina, who also... She was a case herself, but she kept Nero sort of restrained. But in 64, he sort of took over and went around the bend, and ruled ruthlessly. He persecuted the church because when suspicion fell on him that he had set the fire, he blamed the Christians. Mm-hmm. He scapegoated the Christians and persecuted the church viciously from 64 to 68, and it was 42 months. And you think, well, okay,
yeah.
that seems significant.
Yeah.
That kind of thing seems mm-hmm. significant. And so I'm bound by the history of the first century as it happened. So the preterist I'd say the preterist and the historicist both pushed their chips out of the table.
Yeah.
Because the last 2,000 years of history happened the way it happened. And so you've got to make it fit. And I think that the preterist interpretation fits more readily.
Yeah. Zach, you recently preached on Revelation 1, and can you tell us a little bit about your approach to the book as a whole, and then some of the themes that people will encounter as they read this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think John really lays out a lot of the way that we're supposed to read Revelation in the first three verses. So he kind of introduces some themes that he's going to later expound upon, but he opens up with calling this the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, that's actually grammatically ambiguous. Is Jesus the thing that's revealed, or is Jesus himself the revealer? Mm-hmm. And I think in verse 1 and 2, John actually says both. So in verse 1, he says that God gave this revelation to Jesus, who in turn gave it to his servants. So Jesus is both the revealer, and he's also, in verse 2, John witnesses to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ. So he's both revealer and revealed. So when we approach Revelation, we need to be looking for Jesus,
right?
We need to be thinking this book is about Jesus, mm-hmm. and he's what is revealed to us, and he's the one revealing himself to us.
I think it's in chapter 19. It says the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy.
Mm, yeah.
So the spirit of prophecy is to talk about Jesus.
Yeah. And John says that it's a prophecy in verse 3 as well. Yeah. And it's also, John reserves a blessing for those who read this book. So as we approach Revelation, we need to be like pressing in and standing on the promise that God reserves a blessing mm-hmm. for us as we read it. Even in the midst of all of the difficult imagery, symbolism, hard to understand stuff, we need to be kind of standing on that reality.
Yeah.
That even though it's difficult, we need to really press in. A few other things I'll just say here too. Revelation is also the last book of the Bible, and we need to read it as such, which means it's the finale, if you will. And John, Revelation has the most quotes, allusions, references to the Old Testament, more than any other New Testament book.
Far and away.
A conservative number of references is around 500. Mm-hmm. A conservative amount.
Yeah, so it's like every verse there's references, allusions, callbacks.
Exactly.
You know, it's the whole Bible in 22 chapters.
Exactly.
Right?
So as we come to those difficult images, the difficult symbols, we need to not be thinking, like, what does the daily news have to say about this?
Which is nothing good.
like Pastor Wilson would say. Like, we need to be thinking, like, John is thoroughly... Revelation is a thoroughly Hebraic book. Like, John is saturated in his Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be thinking, what does the rest of the Bible have to say about these images or these events?
Yeah.
What stories from the Old Testament is John alluding to when he calls Jesus the faithful witness, when he talks about the 144,000? We need to be thinking Old Testament. How do we read these things in light of that?
Yeah, not only was John saturated in Old Testament, but he's expecting his readers to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are high expectations.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think and you even have it right in the first few chapters where you're finding out, okay, what's a lampstand? Oh, a lampstand is a church. And then you think, where have I ever encountered a lampstand before? And you go back to the building of the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, God was clearly doing something when he's describing furniture and building that. And then we're finding out what exactly those symbols mean explicitly
here.
Yeah. And that's just a good rule of thumb when you're reading the Bible in general. Let Scripture interpret Scripture. But there's a heightened sense of that in the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Pastor Doug, do you have a easy outline for the book of Revelation that you use? I recently read James Jordan's little brief reader's guide, and I think he's got four different outlines, and they all work, you know? And, you know, you got seven trumpets, seven bowls, you know, these different sevens. Is there an outline that you really like or favor?
No, I'm not an outline-y kind of guy.
Okay.
You know, I'm... you know, because, well, there are different structuring devices.
Yeah.
So one of... I remember that Greg Bahnsen once said... David Chilton wrote
Days of Vengeance.
Days of Vengeance of the Book of Revelation. And Chilton... had a very fruitful, he's now with the Lord, but he had a very fruitful mind. And one of the best things about that commentary was him showing all the places where John was drawing on the book of Ezekiel. Mm. So basically, the book of Revelation is a New Testament Ezekiel. But one of Bahnsen's complaints was that Chilton had a pandemonium of structuring devices. So... and after a while, a clever person can just find a chiasm anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so there are chiastic structures. There are numerical repetitions. You alluded seven bowls, seven trumpets, seven. Yeah. And I don't think it's meant to be tidy. Mm-hmm. And outlines try to tidy things up.
Yeah.
And I can't. And frankly, I think I don't know that I've seen a strict outline approach that didn't wind up at some point as a Procrustean bed, mm-hmm. where you, well, now this doesn't actually fit, right?
Yeah.
So I think that if you get a broad, a bird's eye view of the book, mm-hmm. where I do think that there are these things are. Let me correct what I'm saying. I do have one structuring thing where I think that you should think of it in terms of successive waves that cover the same territory, okay. rather than a train with this car in front of this car in front of this car. So I don't think you chug through chronologically up to 70 AD. I think that it's more... let's look at it this way, and let's look at the same thing again this way, and
it's kind of cyclical.
Repetitive. Let's come after it again. So,
okay.
So I don't have a chronological outline.
Okay,
and I do think that the bowls of wrath are poured out on the land, the land of Israel. The seven trumpets, I think, are with regard to the land of Israel.
Yeah.
But I don't think you could reconstruct the Jewish war
right.
from the book of Revelation.
Because the historicists will want to read it not as recapitulating
right.
the same thing. They'll want to say, okay, we've had this phase of church history, then we entered this phase, right. and we're, you know, somewhere in the... they're trying to identify right. which
and
part.
For them, it is a chronological sort of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Great. So let's talk a little bit about symbolism and maybe just help people as they're reading this. So, you know, if you've made it through the Bible Reading Challenge, and especially if people have listened to the podcast, maybe the one on Hebrews, we talked a little bit about symbolism. There's a heavenly reality and an right. earthly copy. And here they're going to count, I mean, something as simple as a mountain or the land right. or the sea. They're not just referring to, you know, Moscow Mountain right there. There's a deep biblical symbolism there. And even the number seven, I mean, we think of the first chapters of the Bible and the creation of the world. And here we have the decreation
right.
of the right, old right. the old world. So maybe do you want to just talk a little bit about symbolism generally? And then I have just a list of symbols that we can go through and try mm-hmm. to define for people.
Okay. Define, it'd be maybe sketch for people or indicate the direction of, because, so for example, in scripture, Jesus is the lion of the tribe of Judah, and the devil wanders around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And you might say, well, what is it?
Are lions good or are lions bad?
Is it Jesus or Satan?
metaphors don't work that way. So metaphors, are not like a, you're not, it's not like you're defining a triangle with an object, a three-sided object. A metaphor can be in taken this way in one place and another way in another place. But that said, for example, in the book of Revelation, you have very much an echo or repeating of what is the case throughout the Old Testament, where the ocean or the sea represents Gentile nations. Mm-hmm. So when the sea is in tumult, it's the nations raging, the tumult. The mountain, you have, and this is a good example of the kind of thing that I was just talking about, where the mountain of the Lord, the temple that was to be destroyed was built on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a mountainous city. Mm-hmm. The temple was on this mountain. And when Jesus says, if you have the faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say, he says, you will say to this mountain, right. Mm-hmm. It's not just
a specific one.
This mountain be yeah. cast into the
not
sea.
This big problem in your life, mountain.
not your irate boss. So you have this mountain on which the temple is sitting. This mountain is going to be thrown into the sea as a judgment, and of course, if the sea is the Gentile nations, and this mountain, the temple of God, is thrown in the sea, you picture being overwhelmed by the Roman armies.
And, yeah.
So there's that, but also throughout the Old Testament, when Israel went astray, they would worship idols in high places, or they would worship the true God on a mountain that was not appointed,
yeah.
right? It was like Gibeon or something like that. So you've got mountains are places of worship, the place where you would expect an intersection between heaven and earth.
Yeah, it's a ladder to heaven.
It's a ladder to heaven. Mm-hmm. Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration goes up on the mountain. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing is routine and expected.
Yeah.
But wickedness can occur on high mountains, and faithfulness can occur on high mountains, and high mountains can be brought in under judgment.
Yeah.
So, and the whole book of Revelation is about the intersection of heaven and earth, mm-hmm. and the judgment of earth according to the standards of heaven. So the voice comes from the temple in heaven. In fact, you could describe the whole book of Revelation in these terms, where it's two layers, two strata. There's worship in heaven, and there's destruction on earth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the worship of God in the heavenly places by the 24 elders and by the living beasts and all of these mm-hmm. Entities in heaven, as they worship him on earth, his will is being accomplished on earth.
Yeah.
So... So judgment falls on this mountain, and this mountain is thrown into the sea as a result of the worship on the heavenly mountain.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does say a lot about when we go to church on Sunday, we don't think about cherubim and, you know, a heavenly host and God raining down, you know, judgment on his enemies. We just think,
I'm in church.
I'm in church. Maybe I like that song. Maybe I didn't. But Revelation, it kind of like peels back the sky and let you see into a little sample of, here's what happened once upon a time when God wrought judgment, and that might not exactly be happening right now, but something like that, you know, that we sit with Christ, we're seated with him and reigning with him.
Yeah, and that actually, you touched on an important point there. The Greek word for revelation is apocalypse. And apocalypse is literally unveiling. Mm-hmm. So you should have the sensation of, down here on earth, I'm sitting out here with all these people in the theater.
Yeah.
And then the curtain opens, and I see on stage all the things that are driving the events here. It's a revelation in that sense. And so another symbol would be the beast, right? A beast using... Old Testament imagery, a beast is a political civil ruler who savages the church or the covenant people of God. That's what beast is in the book of Daniel, for example. So the beast in Revelation would be the same. Throughout the Old Testament, unfaithful Israel is described as a harlot, a whore, a harlot. And so this woman rides the beast. So you've got Rome, the beast, and you've got the harlot, unfaithful Jerusalem, riding the beast. And the instances of Israel's harlotry being described that way are too numerous to, you know, you just have to generally indicate, oh, that comes up in the Old Testament all the time.
Yeah.
And then the grand theme is the basically what you're dealing with is the divorce of the harlot. The harlot is being divorced, put away, and executed, and is being replaced by the virgin bride, the New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So the New Jerusalem is the Christian church, and this is one of the places where our hymns lead us astray, because we think of pearly gates and we think heaven. Well, the pearly gates are a descriptor of the New Jerusalem. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he took me to a high mountain. There it is again.
Yeah.
Took me to a high mountain and showed me the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. Well, there's the bride, the wife of the Lamb.
Yeah.
Well, does Christ have a bride? Well, yes, the Christian church. The New Jerusalem is a perfect cube. 1,200 stadia, that's their unit. We get the word stadium from it.
Mm-hmm.
So 1,200 stadia, which is about 1,500 miles. 1,500 miles across, 1,500 miles deep, 1,500 miles high is a perfect cube. If it were to land on the United States, it would cover from the Mississippi to the Atlantic coast, and it would be knocking satellites out of the sky.
Yeah.
You know, so
take that, literalists.
So you would have a problem. But in the what else is a perfect cube in the Bible? Well, the Holy of Holies.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the temple, the Holy of Holies is a perfect cube where the Ark of the Covenant was.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you point at this perfect cube and you say, there's the bride, the wife of the Lamb, and Paul says in Corinthians, you're the temple of the Holy Spirit, using the word that is descriptive of that Holy of Holies.
Yeah.
It's the golden streets and the pearly gates and all of that is a description of the church and her glory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not a description of heaven.
Yeah.
You talked about mountains so far. We talked a little bit about land and sea. So seas the Gentiles, land or the earth is Israel. And tell me if you take a different view, because probably between the three of us, there's like four different views.
Minimum. Depending on the day, six. You know,
we're good Presbyterians here. What is a star? Doug, I'll start with you, and then if you want to correct him, go ahead.
Well, stars are angels, and angels. So part of this, angels / preachers.
What on earth do you mean?
Well, the heavenly host is. When people say, "I don't think I've ever seen an angel," well, have you looked at a night sky? So the angels that announced the birth of the Lord to the shepherds receded back into their places in the sky. It was a star that led the Magi to the right house in Bethlehem. So stars are not simply, Lewis would say, even in your world, that's not what a star is. That's only what a star is made of.
Yeah.
So
Flaming ball of gas.
So stars are angels, but angels are messengers, okay? And at the very beginning of the book, to the angel of the church of Pergamos, write. To the angel of the church of Ephesus, write. And I take that as a reference to the pastor of the church, which means that I would say the stars are angels / messengers / preachers / the church they represent. That makes sense. So
there's layers going on.
There's layers going on. Yeah. So when the Lord holds the stars in his right hand, it's not like he's holding the pastors and not the church.
Right.
It's all taken together.
Yeah. We have to be comfortable. And I think this is all throughout Scripture.
God likes to mix metaphors in ways that modern people don't like. Yeah. Yeah. And we have to see these kind of blending and merging. And I think Austin Fair has a commentary on Revelation called Rebirth of Images. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's all these different metaphors that are getting mixed together that harken back to Zechariah or Isaiah or mm-hmm. Ezekiel.
Yeah.
And stars is one of those ones that show up in the right. creation account. So there's also something yeah. something mm-hmm. there. We talked about lampstands. Lampstands are churches. Right. What about incense? What's incense?
Incense mm-hmm. would be, that's one that's identified in the book as the prayers of the saints. And you have to remember that in the Old Testament, incense, when you went to the temple, and there's this is another fun thing. One of the things that we've been worshiping under the new covenant for so long that we've forgotten certain aspects of the old covenant mm-hmm. Or neglect to think about them. The temple was a slaughterhouse and smelled like one. Right? Yeah. Right, you're taking thousands of animals. So on some of the dedication ceremonies where Solomon slaughtered thousands of animals, or on any given festival, like the Passover, when Jews from all over the Mediterranean converged on Jerusalem, all of them to sacrifice a sheep in the temple. Well, the temple's a slaughterhouse, and it would smell like a slaughterhouse. It was not a place of special music, for example. Although the temple did have an organ, that's another story. So incense, one of the purposes of incense is to cover up the smell. You know, and a thick, weighty incense is going to overpower or sanctify or glorify what's going on.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we see, the tabernacle of David is the tabernacle when David brings the Ark of the Covenant back before the temple is built. He houses the Ark of the Covenant in the Tabernacle of David, which James at the Jerusalem Council, quoting Amos, identifies with the Christian church. So the Tabernacle of David is identified with the church, the ark is, the thing is consecrated with animal sacrifice, but it's not a place of animal sacrifice. It's music. It's the sacrifice of praise. And one of the best exegetical books I've ever read was Peter Leithart's From Silence to Song, where he talks about this, the Tabernacle of David, and what it means. Well, then when Solomon builds the temple, the Tabernacle of David is sort of incorporated into the temple. But some things go with it, like the music or the name. So the Tabernacle of David was built on Mount Zion. The temple was on Mount Moriah. Well, we, down to this present day, have taken the name, we're marching to Zion, we're going to Zion. It's Zion National Park, not Moriah National Park. So Zion is associated with the city of God. So the music, the sacrifice of praise, the music, the spiritual worship, the prayers, are identified in the book of Revelation as incense, the incense which are the prayers of the saints ascend up to God. And so the incense accompanies the blood of Christ. So the incense of our prayer and praise accompanies the blood of Christ. In the Old Covenant, it was the blood of bulls and goats and physical incense.
Yeah. Let's get into some of the middle chapters here, which I find to be some of the more difficult ones, especially if you're reading this for the first time. It's like, when did a third of the earth, and of the sea? So you need these symbols to help you interpret it. Who are the 144,000 that are referenced in Revelation 7, and then they come up later again?
So one of the things to take when you're dealing with the book of Revelation, which is a book of intricate symbolism, and you look at a number like 144,000, which is 1,000 times 12 times 12, so 12 times 12 times 1,000, And you look at the, is there any significance to the number 12? Yeah, 12 tribes, 12 apostles. That's clearly 12 times 12 times 1,000. And then there's 12,000 from every tribe. Mm-hmm. I think in chapter 7, John hears the number being read, 12,000. The number's a nice, tidy number. In the real census, the tribe of Benjamin would be teeny, and the tribe of Ephraim would be big, and but each one has 12,000. So I think it's clearly
a symbolic number. We're not Mormons that think that only is it the Mormons that think like only 100
or
just J-Dubs. Yeah.
So what John says, he hears the number being read out, and then having heard the number, he says, and then I turned and I looked, and I saw a multitude that no one could number. Mm-hmm. So I think the 144,000. Is a number of fullness or completion. Like you could take it as 12 Old Testament tribes times 12 New Testament apostles times 1,000, the number of completion, and you've got 144,000. And then you turn and look and see a multitude that nobody can number. Mm-hmm. So I take I take 144,000 as being the symbolic of the elect.
Okay.
The number of those who will be finally saved at the end when everyone is gathered in.
So you take the 144,000 and then the great multitude as the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I take them as two different ones. Yeah. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah.
Or a multiple views on that.
Yeah, that's my.
We're all saying the same thing. Yeah, really.
So I would take very similar to what Pastor Wilson just said. Like it's a symbolic. I would kind of take it as a completion fulfillment of Israel, in a sense. So you have the multitude as what I take as Gentiles, and they're a singular people coming together. Mm-hmm. So Exodus 12, you have the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children, and a mixed multitude also went up with them. So you have this idea of an accounted for number of Israelites, and a multitude going with them. So I take this as
Egyptians that got the message.
Egyptians that converted.
Like, come out of here.
So it seems to me that John is talking about kind of a new Exodus people, right? They've been in the wilderness for 40 years. God has been kind of filtering out the unfaithful Israel for 40 years from Jesus's ascension up until 70 AD, mm-hmm. and now they're about to enter into the new promised land, right? There's going to be this cataclysmic event of the destruction of the temple, and then they're going to enter into the new promised land, the world, right, to go and conquer the world. So I kind of see, and maybe you can push back on this, but
that's a reasonable take, and it's the sort of thing where I heard, and then I went and I turned and looked at what I was hearing about.
Right. Yeah. Which happens versus, multiple times.
Right? Yeah. Which happens, or you could say, I heard the number, and that was the number of the completed Israel, the faithful remnant.
Yeah.
That's the number of the faithful remnant. And oh, look, here are all these others who are coming as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's one of the things in this book that's a challenge, where grammatically, it could be any of these views on the grammatical level, and then we have to do the sorting to see what harmonizes the best. Okay, let's talk about seals. So there's seven seals, and then seven trumpets, and then seven bowls. And what is happening when the seals are being unstuck?
Judgments are falling. So this seal is broken, and so in that culture, when you had a seal on a scroll, you didn't know what was in the scroll. Mm-hmm. When you broke the seal, you could unroll the scroll and read what it was going to do, read what it was about. So when the seal is broken on these things, it's time for another judgment to be revealed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in Revelation, you have a book within a book. There's multiple books in this book. And that's part of the thing to follow. So I'd encourage people, it is a worthwhile thing to sit down and try to read through Revelation in one go. I know we're not doing it in the Bible reading challenge, but it's really helpful so you can track with everything that's happening, because there's going to be a book that no one can open. Okay, the Lamb can open it. It's got seven seals. Okay, he's going to start popping these seals. Yeah. And then he's mm-hmm. going to go seven seals, then seven trumpets, and then the seven bowls. Did you want to add something to that?
So the seals, bowls, and trumpets really function as like kind of Russian nesting dolls too. So you have like the trumpets coming out of the bowls, the trumpets coming out of the seals as they're being opened up. So it's not, and this kind of goes back to what Pastor Wilson mentioned before too. It's not the train chugging along through, you know, history chronologically. Yeah. It's the recurring themes and they're opening up from within each other.
And the seals and the trumpets and the bowls are all judgments, but that doesn't mean 21 successive judgments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. It all in a row.
Yeah.
I think it's more like the Russian doll thing, or one wave on the beach comes in, and then a moment later another wave comes and occupies the same space.
Yeah.
So you've got all kinds of. I don't think you could reconstruct what happened to them as 21 discrete events, and then from January to March was the third of the 21.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I don't like it.
I think we also have to ask the question: why a scroll? Like, why is it a scroll that's being unveiled? And this kind of we alluded to it earlier, but Revelation as a whole can really be thought of as kind of a covenant lawsuit against God's people. So he's divorcing Israel, like Pastor Wilson said, and marrying the new Christian church. So God is actually bringing against Israel all of the covenant curses that he promised in Deuteronomy.
Right.
Right? He's actually exercising that judgment. And so the scroll, I kind of take to be God's plan of judgment, but it's also kind of a divorce document. So God even says in, I think it's
Deuteronomy.
In Deuteronomy,
you have, if a man puts a woman away, he has to give her a bill of divorcement.
Yeah,
and that's what these are.
Yeah. Yep. And I think it's either Malachi or Micah. I get those two mixed up. God actually says he's going to give that certificate to Israel. He prophesies that he's actually going to give it to them.
Yeah.
And so I take this as
that
fulfilling that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really cool. Okay, we're going to talk about 666.
Okay.
So is this the COVID microchip?
Oh, yeah.
The vaccine that we're getting prepped for?
This is all about Safeway. This is all about what they're doing to you at Safeway.
Elon Musk.
Yeah. Okay, Doug, I'll give it to you first. I think we probably have different views on this, so go ahead. What is your interpretation of 666?
Okay. It's the number. Well, first, I think there's one obvious thing, and that is throughout the book, 7 is a number of completion, fulfillment, perfection, even if it's a judgment. It's a perfect judgment. 7 stars, 7 lampstands, 7 churches, 7 bowls. It's a completion. And 6 is just shy of that, right?
Yeah.
So, and 777 would be a triune perfection, okay? 666 is a botched attempt to be as God. Right. So you have...
It's a counterfeit.
It's a counterfeit.
Yeah.
Right. So I think there's that level of the symbolism. In the first century, we have in English a system where we write our words with Roman letters and our numerals are Arabic. So we do math with Arabic numerals, and we write letters with Roman letters. In Hebrew and in Greek and in Latin, it wasn't like that. They used their letters did double duty. So the letter D, if English worked that way, the letter D being the fourth letter in, would also be the number 4.
Yeah.
Okay, so to find out the numerical value of Doug, you would come up with 4 numbers and add them up, and that would be the number. That'd be the number of Doug.
Yeah.
So they found graffiti, for example, at Pompeii that says, "I love her whose number is." Well, it wasn't her phone number. Her number was, I scrawled this on a bathroom stall.
Yeah.
And I'm expecting someone who's got the kind of mind now that comes up with bizarre memes for Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's doing the Lord's work.
Doing the Lord's work. So, yeah, someone figured out that Britney Spears, if you rearrange the letters, it spells Presbyterians. and I look at that, I think, and then I checked it. And sure enough it does.
Checks out.
It checks out. But then I ask, what kind of mind sees that opportunity? Yeah. You know, it must have been a slow, rainy
someone
afternoon.
Someone steeped in scripture?
No, or steeped in, but there's a certain kind of mind that can look and see things like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that if John was writing in Greek, which he was, and the number added up to 666 in Greek, that would have been too much of a fat softball pitch. Mm-hmm. Virtually half the church would have just seen right away what mm-hmm. it was. But he says this calls for wisdom. This, you know, mm-hmm. And so basically, if you take Neron Caesar, which is a form of Nero Caesar that occurred on one of his coins, Neron Caesar, and translated it into Hebrew, put it into Hebrew, and added the numbers up, it adds up to 666. So I take Nero as 666. Now, if someone knew it was supposed to be Nero, but he didn't know about the translated into Hebrew part, and he just did it in Greek, it adds up to 616, which is, interestingly, one of the manuscript variations of, is like a scribe knew it was supposed to be Nero, but he didn't get 666 out of it, so he fixed it.
Right.
So I take the number of the beast as being, so, and this is coupled with the seven-headed beast, five were, one is to come. Mm-hmm. I start counting with Julius, even though he was never technically emperor. He was in de facto emperor. So I start with Julius and count five were, the sixth was Nero, one is, mm-hmm. and one is to come. So you couple those two things, I see Nero as the main beast bad guy, mm-hmm. and his number is 666, and there's a plausible way to get that number out of his name.
Yeah, okay. You do have to ask the question that why would John want to hide Nero's name?
Because of the people reading the he was in exile on the Isle of Patmos, mm-hmm. and the book he was writing was seditious and treasonous. Mm. So
it's kind of like avoiding the Facebook filters,
yeah,
sort of thing.
He's writing in code.
Yeah,
I think he's writing, and that's why I said, look, one of you clever guys could figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
Nudge, there's something here. Mm-hmm. But that tells you that whatever it was, John knew what he was talking about. John knew the identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he wasn't expecting some clever sophomore at Ephesus to sit up all night figuring it out and come up with Henry Kissinger. Mm-hmm. You know, who's Henry? Mom, who's Henry Kissinger?
Yeah.
I don't know. Ask the apostle when he gets here. Yeah. Clearly, it's not 2,000 years in the future. John knows who it is.
Hmm.
And John expects the clever ones in among those he's writing mm-hmm. to be able to figure out who it is.
Do you have a different view, or do you take the Nero Caesar view?
So this is one of those feet firmly planted in midair sort of moments. Like I think that's really compelling. I'm also trying to figure out. So 666 isn't the first time, or Revelation isn't the first time that number shows up in the Bible.
Yeah.
You also have in 1 Kings, Solomon takes unto himself 666 talents of gold, mm-hmm. which is a direct rebellion of God's stipulations for a king in Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
Right. He's not to collect gold, girls, or glory for himself, the three G's. So one way of thinking about this is like it's a thoroughly Jewish number.
Yeah,
like
it is the number of a man. And if we're taking man, referring to the Hebrew, it would say it's a Hebrew number.
Yeah. So it seems like John might be talking about some kind of Jewish ruler, rather than a Roman ruler. And I could see how you could maybe say, well, he's talking about a ruler in general, and mm-hmm. that would place Nero as a good option, but it could also be that John's talking about, some kind of, and this gets into one of the other ideas, the whole idea of being a king and economics and politics in the Book of Revelation. There seems to be this overlap with worship, like the economy of worship, too, right? So Jesus even says things like, to the one who cannot purchase, come and drink.
Yeah.
To the one who cannot purchase, come and... So like, there's this overlap of worship and economics and all this sort of imagery going on in Revelation. So it seems like this could be actually referring to some kind of Jewish priest, like the high priest who at the time, or something like that. And this is kind of where I'm like, there's lots of stuff going on, and I'm doing my best to try to figure it out.
Yeah, if you're reading through Kings, and you, there's no way to read through that and come to that number and not trip over it.
Right? Yeah.
You go, huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because I would take the here is wisdom as a harking back to, you think wisdom, you think Solomon, and you think here's an apostate king at the height of his power. And so I think anytime I encounter a symbol, the first thing I want to do is say, okay, has this shown up before? Mm-hmm. And then I'll go to my Josephus or something. Because I used to hold the Nero Caesar view, and I think there's something to, I think you gave the best case for it.
Right.
But then I also want to say, well, I think John is doing something. Also, it shows up in, I think, Ezra and Nehemiah in the, when it's giving the, Adonikim, it's the Jews that returned from exile. And Adonikim literally means the Lord who rises up. And you have right here beasts that are rising up. And so I think he's doing something with the symbols there. And then you could maybe draw different connections to who exactly it is. But I'd want to exhaust the biblical symbol of 666 before I go there.
There's one more thing, and I think this one's getting out on the skinny branches, but
why stop now?
Yeah, why stop now?
Here we are.
So Nebuchadnezzar's statue in Daniel is 6 feet by 60, or not 6 feet, six cubits by 60 cubits.
Yeah.
And then those are the only two measurements, kind of, I think, inferring that the base is actually a cube. So you have the six cubits by six cubits, and then it's 60 cubits.
Mm-hmm.
Tall. Yeah. So it could be also, so skinny branches, but it seems like this one who is represented by 666 is also an idolatrous ruler of some kind, which would obviously go with the Nero thing too. So whether it's Jewish, whether it's Roman, Babylonian,
And the one other additional complication, like we need it, is many people would be surprised to find out the word Antichrist is not in the Book of Revelation at all.
Mm-hmm.
A beast is a persecuting civil ruler.
Mm-hmm.
But persecuting civil rulers generally have religious aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
Like Nebuchadnezzar was a beast, but also wanted worship.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Those are always tied together, it seems.
Yeah. So... an antichrist, a beast would be in modern terms, a beast would be like someone like Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
An antichrist would be a liberal Methodist bishop who denies the incarnation.
Yeah.
That's an antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
So a priest, like an apostate priest, let's say someone from the line of Herod, or let's say an apostate priest in the rebellion, running up to the revolt against Rome, those would be candidates for investigation of what you're talking about.
Yeah,
the Nebuchadnezzar one fits more with Nero.
Yeah,
because Nero had a huge statue made of himself, also just like Nebuchadnezzar. I think it was 90 feet tall or something.
Wow.
Yeah,
big anyway. Guy. Okay, two more symbols. So who is Babylon? Because this is one of the places that expositors will divide, even I think amongst preterists sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who do you take?
The candidates are Rome or Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I believe that it's Jerusalem. So.
And you, would you?
Yeah, I'd say Jerusalem.
Okay. And I take that same view. So
look at that.
It's the right one.
Yeah. This is one of the moments where some preterists take the later date of Revelation to be in the 90s. I think Bonson actually did. And he takes Babylon as Rome.
Okay.
So even as a preterist, he's disagreeing about what exactly is going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think you can't get away from the biblical theology of harlotry, right? All throughout Scripture, the harlot is
the covenant people.
Is the covenant people of God. Yeah. And it has to be. So the reason I don't think it can possibly be Rome is because Rome wasn't covenanted to God as God's people.
Yeah. Wasn't a wife, so he couldn't yeah. be an adulterous wife.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the Revelation 20 binding of Satan, the thousand years. So is this literal? Is this symbolic? Is it happening right now? Is it happening? Is it going to happen in the future?
Well, I don't think it's literal in symbolism. This is another feature of this. If something's symbolic in the book of Revelation, it's symbolic of something, and the something that it's symbolic of is literal.
Yeah.
So if the lake of fire, and symbols are always less than the reality. So a wedding band is less than the marriage, a flag is less than the country. If the lake of fire is literal, it's really, really bad. If it's symbolic, then it's worse than that. Mm. The bottomless pit, if that's literal, if the abyss is literal, mm-hmm. then it's really bad. If it's symbolic, then it's worse than that. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. In Revelation 20, it's regrettable that all three positions, the amill, the postmill, and the premill, take their names from what they say about the millennium. It's mentioned only in Revelation 20.
Yeah.
And so it's one of the most difficult chapters in one of the most difficult books, in one of the most difficult areas of study, and it's only mentioned once, and we've divided up according to amill, postmill, premill. And those terms have to do with where you place the second coming of Christ with regard to the millennium that's mentioned in Revelation 20. Mm-hmm. I take it the binding of Satan, Satan is bound in the course of the millennium, mm-hmm. And I take that as the church age, from Pentecost till the second coming. Okay. If Satan is bound, in what respect is he bound? Mm-hmm. What do you mean? And if you look at Revelation 20, you see that his former activity that he's bound from being able to continue is that of deceiving the nations. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that Satan is removed entirely from earth. Mm-hmm. It's not, I believe that he's bound with regard to, there will never be a Babylon with a satanic force behind it, mm-hmm. or Persia, or Rome with a satanic demonic force behind it. There have been attempts, because of man's sinfulness, the Third Reich was an attempt to build a demonic empire, but it craters after a few years. I don't think that can be done in the New Testament, in the era of the New Testament, because Satan is bound.
He's bound to matters.
What he's bound to what he's bound to prevent matters.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's not a total inactivity or inability to.
So Jesus, and it's really striking that Jesus says that you can't pillage the strong man's house unless you bind him. Mm-hmm. Right. So Satan is the strong man. Jesus talks about his activity as binding the strong man. And then he can take all his stuff. He strips him, in Luke, he strips him of his panoply or his armor. Mm. So I take Satan as bound in that respect, not Satan as bound as being a nullity or non-existent. Or I think there's still demonic activity, satanic activity.
But part of this too comes in Matthew 4. Satan tempts Jesus with the nations of the earth, right? So which means that Satan, at a time,
Had them.
He possessed them and was able to offer them to Jesus.
Yeah.
Right. So he possesses them, but then Jesus calls Satan the ruler of this world too in John. Mm-hmm. But then Jesus at his ascension, as he's going up, he says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." So he's removed them from Satan's possession.
That's what I think the binding is talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Final exhortation for people as they're reading this book. It closes with two, beautiful chapters of what, the church coming down, every tear wiped away. So how can we read this book faithfully, wrestling with it, but also not miss the forest for the trees? One of those. I always get that mixed up.
Yeah, so I would encourage people to, if they want to read with the promised blessing in mind, to simply sit loose in the saddle and read without trying to do things to the book. Let the book do things to you. Just say, I don't want to figure it out. Yeah. If you read through it the first time with a pencil and a pad, you're just going to make a hash of it.
Yeah.
So I would just read it and then read it again and let the book become acquainted with its cadences and its style and its way of expression. Yeah. And I think you will receive the blessing.
Yeah. Pastor Wilson, as I've heard you say before, it is a revelation. It's meant to reveal something to us, not to cover things up.
Right.
Right. So as we read, don't get bogged down in the weeds, and let it wash over you. And like we said at the very beginning, Jesus is revealing himself.
Right.
Like, as you read, the risen and ascended Jesus is the one speaking to you.
Yeah.
He is the one washing over you with the water of the word. So,
a couple of quotes from the front of the book. I quote Chesterton and Ambrose Bierce. Chesterton says in Orthodoxy, "And though St. John saw many strange monsters in his vision, he saw no creature so wild as one of his own commentators." So, that's one thing to keep in mind. And then Ambrose Bierce in the Devil's Dictionary said, "Revelation, a famous book in which St. John the Divine concealed all that he knew. The revealing is done by the commentators who know nothing." But we take issue with the that first part. St. John was a thundering genius, I think. But he's concealing nothing. He's talking to us, but we have to let him talk to us the way he would talk to us.
Right.
And I think that means relax, let it go. Don't try to over-engineer it. Just read it and reread it. Let it have its work on you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you've been on the Same Page summer reading train, I think the train is the controlling metaphor for this summer season. Well done. You've made it to the end. And we'll have a new season of Bible reading where we'll get to do hopefully some of these same things, but with the Old Testament. So until then, keep on reading.